when you hear that music, you know what time it is. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair, coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT on a Tuesday morning that feels like a Monday. I feel like everybody should get a pay bump for just coming in on a Tuesday morning that feels like a Monday, because it's its own kind of ugh. But we're going to get through it together because, you know, you love me, I love you, it's great. Everything's going to be good. Today, a victory for North Florida voting rights advocates and the culture wars of Warren Folks. Tim Gilmore is the author, plus the latest sports news and notes. So it's going to be a jam-packed full day, but starting off. On Saturday, a state judge sided with voting rights plaintiffs, finding Governor Ron DeSantis' map of North Florida congressional districts illegally reduced black voters' electoral power. Andrew Pantazzi has been covering the story for the Tributary, and he is here with me now in the studio for the latest. If you want to join the conversation, you can. Call us at 549-2937, tweet us at FCC on air, and email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can message us on Facebook, connect with us there. So, Andrew, how are you this morning?
I'm good.
It's a Tuesday that feels like a Monday. It's just weird.
It means that we get a shorter week. I'm looking forward to
okay,
it.
Okay, so like I can sign on to that. That is definitely good. So well, you were just here, weren't you? Weren't you here with me Friday?
Yeah.
All right. Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
So, can you break down this news to me? Like, let's start way back at the beginning. So, Governor DeSantis decided that he wanted to change districts in North Florida. What was the stated impetus behind that?
Yeah. So, for 30 years, Jacksonville has had a congressional seat that has been drawn specifically to allow black voters here to be able to elect their preferred candidate. For many years, that was Corrine Brown. For the last few years, it's been Al Lawson, Democrat out of Tallahassee. And the legislature was proceeding as normal. They were drawing a map that, at least in North Florida, was fairly similar to last decade's map. It cleaned some things up. It made some things a little more compact, but it was largely the same. And on Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, Governor DeSantis came out and criticized the legislature and said he drew his own map, which would get rid of that district, and instead divide up the black population along North Florida into four different districts. And he released that map. Initially, the Republican leadership in the legislature, one of the very, very rare times, stood against him, and they refused to buckle. They passed their own map, which had two versions of North Florida districts. One was a Duval-only district, just Jacksonville, and another still continued that stretch of Jacksonville to Gadsden County and Tallahassee in the west. The governor vetoed that map, said he believed it was unconstitutional, violated the U.S. Constitution to draw a map that was specifically trying to protect black voters, and he muscled through his own one, which is the one we have now. And so for the first time in three decades last year, black voters in Jacksonville weren't able to elect any candidates anywhere in North Florida who were their preferred candidates. Instead, in each congressional election, the candidate preferred by white voters was the one who won.
I just want to go back a little bit, because it's clear to me, after watching Governor DeSantis over the years, that symbolism is very important to him. That, like, when he decides that he's going to push through, I don't know, anti-LGBTQ legislation, like he goes to New College and mm-hmm. announces it there in their pink palace, so to speak, right? So, like, he's doing all this purposefully. So when he announced that he wanted to do this on Martin Luther King, the holiday, that seems very purposeful.
Yeah.
That seems like he is trying to make a statement to both sides of the equation, I guess, not just to his black constituents, but to white ones as well, that, like, we're not going to stand for this anymore.
Yeah, I think so. It has, I think, a similarity to, 1980, Ronald Reagan going to Philadelphia, Mississippi, to give a speech. There is a symbolism. There is something communicated just by the venue and the timing of when certain things happen. And I think that was probably true here too. Obviously I can't say that with any certainty, but regardless, it's significant whether it was intended or not that this was announced during Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, which, you know, Martin Luther King, one of his greatest accomplishments was bringing us the Voting Rights Act through, you know, the marches in Selma, which led to, you know, the types of districts like Jacksonville's district allowing Black voters in North Florida who had been denied representation ever since Reconstruction to be able to finally have a special district drawn to empower their vote.
And I'm asking you this question because I just want to make sure that I understand the argument correctly. And you've been working on this forever. So my understanding is that what his lawyers are arguing is that it is unconstitutional because it basically like is race based, because it like looks at like a Black community and says that that community deserves representation. So his idea, DeSantis and his lawyers, that what they're arguing is just because it's about race, that is unconstitutional. Am I correct in that?
Yeah. Basically, that's right on kind of the broad strokes of it. It's, you know, more than 10 years ago, Florida voters passed changes to the state constitution called the Fair Districts Amendments, changed the way that we draw our congressional and our legislative maps. And one of the things that we included in the Fair Districts Amendments, one of the most powerful things, was we codified language from the Voting Rights Act, the Federal Voting Rights Act, directly into our state constitution. And one of those protections, which went further than the Voting Rights Act, was we took this language that said, once there's a district that allows a racial minority or language minority group to elect their preferred candidates, you can't diminish from that, that you can't reduce their voting power. You need to continue to enable them. And so in North Florida, that was the protection that was given to the North Florida district. And that's based on language that's in the Voting Rights Act. And Governor DeSantis says that that language on its face violates the U.S. Constitution. And there's really something that is extraordinarily audacious. This is, again, kind of has historical ties to, you know, thinking of denying, refusing to comply with U.S. Supreme Court desegregation orders, is that the governor's argument in court has been, I do not need to follow state law. I do not need to follow the state constitution. If I think the state constitution violates the U.S. Constitution, I can ignore it at will. And traditionally, what the courts have said is, no, you have to comply with it, even if it violates the U.S. Constitution. And then it's up to a citizen, it's up to private people to sue the state and to get it overturned. But only a court can determine that your state law is unconstitutional. The governor doesn't get to decide it all on his own. Mm-hmm. And this comes at the same time that this governor has removed two elected state attorneys who are democratically elected because he says that they're not following state laws because they believe that they violate the U.S. Constitution. So at the same time, he's removing them
for doing exactly what he wants to do.
Yeah, for allegedly doing what he openly, explicitly to the court said. In no uncertain terms, he said, I know this violates state law. I know what I did violate state law, and I'm okay with that because I believe state law is wrong. And so there was no dispute over the facts. This was not like a trial where there's two sides arguing over what happened. Both sides agreed that the governor came in and he violated state law, but the governor's side says, we don't believe state law should be followed. We believe we should be allowed to violate it because we think it violates the U.S. Constitution. And it's not as if the U.S. Supreme Court hasn't heard these arguments. Like the U.S. Supreme Court has had many opportunities to overturn this language that is in the Federal Voting Rights Act, and they never have. But he's hoping that his own state Supreme Court will go further than the U.S. Supreme Court ever has.
Question that you may not be able to answer, mostly because this goes to intention. But do you think that the DeSantis administration is emboldened by the fact that, like, in the last, you know, decade, we have watched the Voting Rights Act be basically gutted by the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. In fact, they've said that explicitly in their arguments to the court. So before the U.S. Supreme Court made its decisions this last term, which strengthened the Voting Rights Act for the first time in a decade where they've had a Voting Rights Act strengthening decision, they kept saying, look, the U.S. Supreme Court took up this case out of Alabama, and we all know that they're going to rule against, you know, the Voting Rights Act was essentially the undertone. And then the U.S. Supreme Court didn't. The U.S. Supreme Court voted to uphold their past rulings and voted to uphold the Voting Rights Act. And so I think that was a surprise, and that set back the governor's legal argument. But they were hoping, hey, either, even if it's not the Florida Supreme Court, I think they were hoping maybe we can bring this to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they're going to obviously side with us. Now it's less obvious, and now the precedent is not as strong as what they thought was going to come down. And so I think that puts them in a trickier situation.
Let me ask you this, like, just looking at it from a 50,000 feet view, right? Would it be correct in saying that right now the Republicans have a supermajority in the Florida legislature?
Yes.
So knowing that, I'm curious, like, why this one district matters enough to him that he has to go to court and put a considerable amount of resources, because, like, when he's going to court to fight for this, he's spending taxpayer money.
A lot of taxpayer money.
So I'm just trying to wrap my head around, like, why is this so important to him politically to get rid of one district when he's already got a supermajority and can pretty much pass? I mean, he's passed pretty much anything that he wants. He gets it through. So I'm just trying to understand what that is about.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the important contrasts between him and the legislature last year was the legislature went through its process and they drew extraordinarily fair maps for the legislature and Congress, and they were applauded for it. And I have to think part of that is they had court-ordered fair maps last decade, and still Republicans were able to win. Republicans in the state of Florida are better at campaigning, better at winning elections than Democrats are, and under fair maps, Republicans tend to win most seats. That's the way it is. That is the stance of the parties right now. And I think they were fine with, okay, we can pass fair maps. And yes, it means there's a Democratic district in North Florida, but throughout the state, we're still going to have most seats. And I think they wanted to avoid the embarrassment of going through a trial process, going through a court process. And the governor was kind of the sole voice saying, no, I'm not okay with those types of maps. We need to instead overturn this. There is a national movement toward this. There's a lot of national funding toward overturning anything race-based. We see this with affirmative action in schools, which the U.S. Supreme Court did overturn. Mm-hmm. We see this with Voting Rights Act challenges. There are a lot of national big money interests dedicated to overturning anything that is race conscious or race based.
All right. And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Ed on line one. Ed, how are you doing this morning?
Good. Thank you. Great show as always.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say something here. You know, I wonder if the districts are designed by Republicans or the Democrats, not because of any particular affinity for or malice against a particular group, or simply based on the voting statistics. The overwhelming majority of blacks happen to be voting Democrats. If they were voting Republican, do you think that would not make a difference? I give an example of the Hispanic, which I'm familiar with. They're voting overwhelmingly Republican, especially in South Florida. If the Democrats take over the state again, do you think they would have any problem going and breaking those districts up if they give them some kind of advantage? And then they're going to do it not because they're anti-Hispanic, simply because they want to win. So that's basically, we try to make everything into racial ethnicity and maybe just politics. That was it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.
Yeah, so Ed brings up an interesting point. There's this one district, for example, in South Florida that stretches all the way from Immokalee and LaBelle to Miami, which, if you're familiar with South Florida, that means in between those two places, there's nothing. There's entire counties of, like, no people living there. You've got the Everglades. You've got vast land. That is not a compact district. That is, you are connecting two extremely different groups. And what you're doing there is you're connecting more Democratic-leaning Hispanic voters in Immokalee and LaBelle, and connecting them to Hialeah, which is very Republican-heavy Cuban voters. And so there you saw there was an intentionality. They said they were doing this on race-based reasons. The governor has not opposed the race-based reasons of connecting Latino voters in South Florida in a way that maximized Republican performance. And so I think that does show one of the examples. And the other one I would say is the Secretary of State himself, who's the named defendant here, former Jacksonville Representative Cord Byrd. He led the state legislative subcommittee, which also used race throughout its drawing of districts. at the time, I think appropriately following the state constitution, but they were fine with that there. And now they're saying actually race-based districts, when you're considering black race, is not okay. And
but when you're considering white and Latino,
yeah, when you're considering the Latino South Florida districts, that's fine to them because that is something that they don't have to worry about it being meaning you're drawing a Democratic district.
Sure.
And so,
and I would also push back on the caller and say that, like, we live in America, and I'm always, I don't know, skeptical when people want to pull race out of the equation instead of keeping race in the equation, because we live in the United States of America, that, like, you can't untangle these things. It's messy. It's not great for the narrative that people want to put forward, but race is something that we cannot escape in this country because we haven't dealt with it. So when it comes to politics, and you're watching a politician dismantle the voting power of a certain group, and he begins his assault on that voting power on Martin Luther King's anniversary or holiday
birthday.
It sends a message. It sends a message that clearly is saying that I am focusing on race. And there are a lot of people who will say, well, let's take this away from what race. And I would say that they're counting on you saying that, like, well, this is not race, but we just need to call it what it is and look at it for exactly what it is, and not be scared of that. Because the only way we move forward through race is by actually confronting it instead of running away from it and saying, well, maybe it's not that. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air, First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, and you can also find us on Facebook. So in this district that the Republicans in the legislature and Governor DeSantis created, who has been the representative for this district?
Yeah, so that's Representative Aaron Bean from Fernandina Beach, a white Republican, Nassau County, representing the, you know, north side, west side of Jacksonville, and it also connects Nassau County and Clay County. And then, you know, our other representative is John Rutherford, former sheriff, another white Republican who represents south side and south and east of the river and connects to St. John's County.
And just to be clear, Aaron Bean is the representative for the Grand Park area where the mass shooting happened a couple weeks ago. Has Aaron Bean been at the scene at all? I haven't seen him.
I believe he was at the prayer vigil the next day. I believe State Representative Angie Nixon had said he had been in touch with her that first day. I think she put something out about that. I think a contrast, actually, that's interesting is at that prayer vigil where the governor spoke and where he was booed. I heard Congressman Bean was there as well, but I think he more appropriately kind of took more of a back seat, more of a listening, you know, not speaking, not feeling the need. But with that is, you know, there's not somebody there who does feel like they are the voice of the community in Congress, who comes from the community in the same way that we've had in the past.
I think at that prayer vigil that you were just mentioning, Governor DeSantis got booed pretty heartily.
Yeah.
For me, watching that, it felt like the black community, specifically in that area, that was feeling a grievous hurt, pain, from the death of three of its residents. And watching a man who just stole their voting power, that actually was really not a threat to him. It just felt like it smacked of hypocrisy for him to come and speak to those same people.
Literally the same week as the racist killings at Dollar General, just days before the governor arrived, his lawyers argued in court, yes, we diminished black voting power, and we think that was okay. And in a separate case, they argued in court on the Stop Woke Act. They said, which the Stop Woke Act does a bunch of things, one of which is it bars diversity training by employers. Any diversity training that teaches someone has been discriminated on by the basis of race is illegal if it's a mandatory training. And what the governor's lawyers told the appellate federal courts was that they wanted to stop employees who wanted that training, because the court asked, why not just have someone sue for you know, that mental distress? And they said, we need to protect people from themselves on learning about racial discrimination.
All right, and we're going to go to the phones. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, what's your name?
This is Dave. I'm in Nassau County.
Go ahead, Dave. Tell me what you got.
The point I wanted to make is that nothing is going to change until the corrupting influence of money is taken out of politics. Right now, politicians are pretty much bought and paid for. They don't care about their constituents. They care about their donors. And so, therefore, we're going to continue to have laws that are made by the well-connected and moneyed interests, and the rest of us just fight over the scraps. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. We've got a couple of comments from Facebook. We've got Lisa saying, but black voters do not have a representative government. They do not have opportunity to elect who they want to vote and who will represent them. The judge affirmed that. And then Catherine from Regency said, does the city have maps drawn by computers?
So these are not maps drawn by, you know, algorithm or AI or anything like that. It is drawn on computers with software, but it's by people themselves, both the state and for our local city council. It's all drawn by people.
Yeah. So do you think Governor DeSantis intended this to reach the Supreme Court and become a test of the right of black voters?
I think so. I think he has shown a willingness on a lot of kind of orthodoxy to show that he's willing to stand up and he's willing to advance conservative principles, more right-wing principles to the U.S. Supreme Court and through the courts. And I think we're seeing that with a lot of laws he's passed, a lot of laws that get enjoined by federal courts. But, you know, sometimes it's, as you say, about the message it sends, and sometimes it's about trying to overturn past precedent.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is a lawyer who deals with a lot of Supreme Court stuff. And he was telling me that in his view, Supreme Court Chief Justice Roberts, that his whole goal from, you know, when he first started clerking was to dismantle the Voting Rights Act, that he felt like the Voting Rights Act was unfair and unneeded. And I believe in an interview at one point, he said that racism really doesn't exist anymore. And so his idea was that, like, if we go through and dismantle it, it makes the playing ground fair for everyone, which gives me pause in hearing that, like, DeSantis wants to get this to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so Chief Justice Roberts started out in Ronald Reagan's Department of Justice, Office of Legal Counsel, writing memos back in the 1980s about how you would dismantle the Voting Rights Act. And he was the author of Shelby v. Holder, which eliminated preclearance. Certain places, especially in the South, had to get changes to voting laws and changes to maps pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. And that had been, I think, a long-term project for him. What's been interesting in this last term was when he upheld a lower court's decision out of Alabama, finding that Alabama violated the Voting Rights Act, he also seemed really upset that the court had, in past decisions, basically instructed Congress, struck down things, and Congress had repassed them, fixing the problems as the court had instructed. And his idea was, if Congress is complying with what we've told them, if we've said, here's how you can fix this, and you fixed it, then how can I now come in and say, actually, we're still going to strike it down? And he seemed particularly offended by that concept. I think similarly here, what's happened is when they struck down parts of the Voting Rights Act, they kind of had instructions which Florida in the Fair Districts Amendment really complies with. And so that's where I don't know. I don't think anybody should feel confident one way or the other how the courts would act. But When you have courts, especially when they strike down laws and they give instructions to legislatures on how they can fix them, it just seems like an upside down world if they continue to turn to change their mind later on and say, actually, even though you complied with what we said, we're now going to again strike down your new law.
And we're going to go to the phones. Hey, caller, how are you this morning?
Hey, good morning, Al. My question is, you know, the Republicans seem to me, are they afraid of the browning of American voter base, that we're so much more diverse now, and that's why they're attacking all these, you know, they're afraid that their base is dwindling demographically to the point where they just can't win anymore without using legislative tricks?
Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't know if afraid is the right word or not, but I think that they have figured out ways to maintain control, especially like with this congressional map. It's just the weird thing this goes to what Al and I were talking about earlier is that when there have been fair maps in Florida, frankly, Republicans are just better at campaigning, so they're still able to win. I mean, the supermajority they have in the legislature was done under a fairly fair map when Democrats completely collapsed in their campaign last year. And so it's not as if they need this to have a majority. But when it comes to the congressional seats, you know, this is one district they would not have won under the old map. And so, you know, this does give them one extra seat, which does also help give them the majority in Congress that they currently have in the House of Representatives. I do think there is historically always been this threat of black representation that came up in the Reconstruction era South that was dismantled for 100 years, which is why it took so long before we had more black representatives in Congress. And still to this day, there have been so few black members of Congress, black senators. And so, you know, getting rid of one of the few seats that has consistently allowed black voters to elect representatives who they choose is significant. It's powerful and meaningful to those voters who live in Jacksonville neighborhoods who feel like they don't get the same kind of representation when they are such a minority, such a small population in a whiter district.
We're going to close out with a comment on Facebook. Josh said he was just telling a friend that it bothers me that every time they do a show about redistricting, the number of black conservatives, for example, is growing, not shrinking. Josh, I don't know where you got your numbers from, but I don't believe that is 100% true. I think that the number of if it's growing at a pretty small rate. But that's not really what the subject is about. Redistricting isn't necessarily about whether black people are Democrat or Republican. It's about taking power from the black community, regardless of where they stand. That's just my thoughts on Josh's message from Facebook. Andrew Pantazzi, he is running the Tributary and working on this story. I should say that I'm a board member of the Tributary. Andrew, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you so much, Al.
All right, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. Jacksonville-based author Tim Gilmore's latest tome, The Culture Wars of Warren Folks, is a critical biography of a self-avowed white supremacist who ran for office in the 1960s through the 90s. He's here now with more on the book and how it ties to present day. Tim, hello, hello, hello.
Hey, Al, it's so good to see you again.
It's good to see you too, man. It's been a minute.
It has.
So this is your 23rd book.
Yeah. I can be a little obsessive, you know. But
I think that's kind of an understatement at 23, man. That's a lot.
There's a lot of stories out there.
I feel like such a slacker. Like I got ideas for books, and like, nope, they're not getting done.
You know what? I just have to say real quick. I love listening to you and Andrew, and whatever you have done and wherever you have gone, you have always been good to our hometown. So, I just wanted to say that.
Thank you very much. And yeah, I'll make sure you get that check.
Right.
So, I kind of remember Warren Folks, I just remember the name,
right?
But I don't remember like who he was. So please tell me, who is Warren Folks?
Yeah. So I had heard of him, and there's a chapter in Rodney Hearst's book, his first book. The chapter is just called Warren Folks. But I had kind of forgotten about him. And then last November, I was researching book bans in Florida from back in the day. You know?
Why would you do that?
Yeah, I wonder. Well, that's the thing, is so much of Warren Folks' story is frighteningly similar to a lot of what's happening right now. So I was researching these, and I found Warren Folks when he was, this was 1970. He was offended that the library had a Mickey Spillane novel, and made a big to-do about it, and this will sound familiar, he called for all funding to be canceled for the Jacksonville Public Library system until every book in the library system had been screened, which got no traction, but so many of his ideas, and he was as, you know, honestly vicious and extreme as you can imagine, but so many of his ideas actually have kind of a mainstream place now.
Well, now, like those ideas may have been fringe way back when, but I think we can kind of track how in popular culture, the things that were fringe are slowly brought in and slowly made acceptable. I'm thinking a lot about, I'm not even going to say his name, but there was a white supremacist troll who was doing very well in 2016, and everybody was calling him a sexy new think tank, but he was just really like a Klansman without a robe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was, you know, everybody saw him for who he is, but a lot of the ideas that he was championing back in 2016 have made their way into policy. Have come into like the mainstream now. So like all the things that you're talking about with Warren Folks that seem to be extreme and far off now feel a little closer to, you know, where we are today.
There were so many people that I spoke with who remembered him and had interactions with him, who said, yeah, everybody knew who Warren Folks was in the 60s and the 70s, less so in the 80s, but still, but that he would probably fit in with today's political landscape more than he did in his own. But, you know, the thing is, I mean, it's called The Culture Wars of Warren Folks, and he came about in this particular era of the culture warrior politician. I mean, you know, I was listening to you and Andrew, so much of what you said ties directly to what's happening in this book. And, you know, folks came about, George Wallace, famously, you know, segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, was first governor of Alabama from 63 to 67. Lester Maddox, you know, who made the axe handle the symbol of his successful campaign for governor, was governor from 67 to 71. And Claude Kirk, Florida's George Wallace or Lester Maddox, and maybe a prototype for somebody who's around today, was governor those same years, 67 to 71. This is when folks really came into his own and established this role as constant culture warrior.
Yeah. What were some of the other controversies that he started?
Oh man, you know, he went from one thing to another, but there were and some of the things are so extreme that they still read, like, you know, they're so ludicrous that
yo, you got to give us one.
So one of the more ludicrous ones was that there was an FDA seizure of apricot pits from a health food store in St. Augustine. And Warren folks did not like anything really that the government did. Anything the government did was government overreach. So he protested the seizure of these apricot pits, which some people thought could be a cure for cancer, but they actually contained cyanide. And he accused federal marshals of eating 400 and something pounds of apricot pits to hide the evidence. So that's one of the more ludicrous.
Yeah, that's crazy.
But, you know, the first time that the mayor's office actually got security against the threat of gun violence was because of Warren Foulkes, because he would bring a gun anywhere into public that he could, and make a point of saying, if you have a problem with this, then you have a problem with my constitutional right. And he brought a shotgun into the mayor's office. And when the mayor's office put up security, he made the newspapers constantly. He made the newspapers doing a little victory march in front of the mayor's office.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he ran for governor in 1990. What are some of his campaign promises?
Oh man. So he ran for multiple offices. He ran for sheriff. He ran for representative, senator, council member. He actually, in losing his Senate seat, he claimed that the election was stolen. And so again,
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, again,
losing election and saying it's stolen.
So many uncanny echoes.
That's,
you know,
crazy.
But his platform over the years rarely changed. It was always race based, you know, and so interesting to hear you and Andrew talking about people with this idea that racism doesn't really exist anymore. You know, I've read a few people lately who have said that the whole anti-woke thing is really anti-racism, as though if you say you are anti-racist, you are the one who's being...
You're the new version of what racism is.
It's like this
weird reverse... It's literally like being a kid at elementary school and saying, "No, I'm not. You are."
Absolutely. Yeah, but it's almost as though just saying that racism exists is offensive.
Yeah,
in and of itself. But, you know, race was always central to his platform. He argued for vouchers to send public school kids to private schools. He was always against taxation, always, gun rights. He was against teaching evolution in schools. In the late 80s and into the 90s, he started to focus a lot more on LGBT issues. And I just want to point out one real quick irony that I actually love.
Yeah.
So across from the Jesse Ball DuPont Center, is this old building. It's the United Cigar Store building.
Mm-hmm.
And in the late 60s, there was a George Wallace for President campaign office in that building. And then Warren Foulkes had his barber shop in, and as he called it, Conservative Church of Christ in that building for a decade. And now there is a new gay bar opening there called Hardwick's. And I just love the irony of that.
So can you tell us what the what you think the relevance of Warren Foulkes' legacy is today?
Yeah, yeah. You know, honestly, I wrestled a lot with whether to write this, how to write it. Sometimes in the midst of it, I would feel like this is really important because it has all of these, you know, hyperlinks to today. And sometimes I would feel like, am I just putting his poison back out there again? You know, like does the community need this? And I don't think I would have written this book if the last couple of years hadn't happened. You know, I teach at FSCJ. The last 3 years, I hosted our annual workshop for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And the week before that workshop was to happen this year, and did happen, but the week before is when you know, the governor started making his statements about DEI and shutting down DEI across Florida. So I think, you know, folks rose in this era, which was a racist backlash to what, to civil rights progress, in this era of the culture warrior politician. And we are in, you know, we can make whatever prognostications about what might happen in the next couple of years, but we're in another era of that kind of politician.
So you've got an event coming up Thursday, yes. September 14th. Tell me about it.
Yeah. It's at the Jacksonville Historical Society. Doors open at 5:30 and presentation starts at 6. It's the book launch. And so people can get tickets. I think you guys are putting the link on the site.
Yep.
So yeah. And so, you know, I'd love to have lots of people come out.
Tim Gilmore, The Culture Wars of Warren Foulkes. He has a book launch happening on Thursday, September 14th. Go out and listen and hear all the connections to today. Tim, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Al.
And we'll be right back.
The next fresh air, Zadie Smith. She's known for her essays and novels about contemporary life and art, but her new book is a historical novel set in Victorian England. Her characters are dealing with some of the same issues we face today: gender inequality, class divisions, and the perpetual consequences of slavery. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Thank you. I'm Deepa Fernandez. In the new season of his acclaimed PBS show America Outdoors, Baratunde Thurston gives us his take on living in and with nature. Sometimes it gets too close for comfort.
Mario picks up the snake. So why don't you pet the snake? Cool, cool, cool. And then before I know it, I'm holding the snake all by myself.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
New York Times bestselling author Alex Al has been described as one of the country's most honest voices. Her work on self-discovery, emotional processing, and building inner strength has helped millions. Al joins us to talk about her latest work, The Power of Ritual, and why her day cannot start without a cup of tea. That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Hi, I'm Jen White, the host of 1A. There's something special about how public radio can make you feel in unexpected ways.
Your hands become sweaty, your pupils become dilated, your breathing quickens, your heart gets faster.
Okay, maybe that's extreme, but it feels good to understand how people feel, whether they're riding highs or enduring lows, to feel connected. Please help keep this station strong by giving today.
Please call 353-9528, and thank you.
And we are back. It is finally here, the first week of the NFL regular season, as the Jags begin their defense of the AFC South title. I'm going to call it right now, the Jags begin the domination. I got a lot of friends who are Dallas Cowboy fans, and I just got to say, I feel sorry for you. Plus, college football is back full swing this week, and we have our friend to talk to us about all of this stuff, Josh Torres. Josh, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Al. Doing great.
Okay, so do you agree with me that like we're starting the Jaguar domination?
I would say yes.
Okay.
It's definitely going to be very, very interesting. Before we get to the Jags, I did want to give two little sports shout-outs, just because these are really big things that happened this past weekend.
Do it.
First, we have the Nebraska volleyball team set a women's sports world record by hosting 92,000 people to watch a game that they did in the Nebraska State Football Stadium. Great to see. There's all kinds of really great women's sports. It's still sports. Like, they're still great to
absolutely
watch. I highly recommend everybody, please support these women's sports. This Thursday, UNF's women's soccer team is hosting the number 2 ranked Florida State Seminoles at Hodges Stadium. It's free admission, so feel free. Go out there. Enjoy it. Like, there's still great sports action.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one, I've told you, and anybody who knows me knows, I'm a huge racing fan. And I want to give a huge shout-out to Mr. Miles Rowe. You guys might not know that name, but you're going to very soon. He just became the first African-American to win an open-wheel racing series in the U.S. He won the USF Pro 2000 Series. And with this, he actually received a $600,000 scholarship to move up to the next. So he's on the road to Indy. So he's trying to get into the IndyCar Racing Series. He won a $600,000 scholarship to help fund his next season, which he will be in Indy next, which is one step below IndyCar. So remember that name, Miles Rowe. I've seen him race the last 2 years in St. Petersburg. This kid is very, very fast, very, very good, and I absolutely expect we will be seeing him winning more championships very, very soon.
What is the open wheel?
So think Formula One. They're cars. They don't have fenders. You see the wheel. That is the very basic concept.
Okay. Because I know nothing about racing except that NASCAR happens in Daytona, and I've never been.
Yep. It is. Think the Indianapolis 500. Think Formula One. That is open wheel.
Okay. So these are like the narrow cars. With,
yep.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So he's moved up. He gets a scholarship
to move up to the next series just below IndyCar, which is Indy next. And so then next year, that's where he's going to be racing. And if he can win again or do very well, I will expect to see him in IndyCar very soon.
All right. I will keep an eye out for it. All right. Let's move on to your beloved Jaguars, please.
Yes.
Tell me, who are they playing first?
So they are playing the Indianapolis Colts. Obviously, everyone expects the Jags to win the division this year. This game is going to be a very interesting one. Colts are very much in a rebuilding, and they have Anthony Richardson as their quarterback. This is a kid who I think a lot of us were surprised how high he was taken, because he's a very raw talent. You know, He went to the University of Florida, only started for one full season, really didn't show off his passing too much. He was much more of a runner. So it's going to be very interesting. This does seem like it could be a trap game for the Jags, though. So this is one that they're going to have to take very, very seriously. And don't look down. Like, remember, this is still a professional football team. You still got to play them like they're a professional football team. So it's going to be very interesting to see. But I do expect the Jags to come out of Indianapolis with a victory.
And then after Indianapolis, how would you rate their schedule?
It's definitely going to be tough. I mean, right after that, they had the season opener against the defending Super Bowl champs, the Kansas City Chiefs. You know, they host the Baltimore Ravens. They host Cincinnati. They go to play the San Francisco 49ers. They play the Bills in London. Like, these are all playoff teams that they're going to be playing against. If they have any hope of making it even close to the Super Bowl, they have to beat or at least take these guys the distance. You know, they can't get blown out by these guys. They have to take them the distance. So it's going to be a very, very tough test this season. But, you know, the team really looks good and really looks like they are set for that.
Okay, and so on the college side, we got some big matchups coming up.
Oh, we have some big matches coming up, but we just saw our first taste of college football. So the two teams I really want to focus on is the University of Florida down in Gainesville had just an absolutely abysmal game. They lost 24-11 to Utah. Just really looked dysfunctional. It's the second year under head coach Billy Napier. And so it's going to be very interesting to see how they kind of move forward. And also just how patient our fans going to be. You know, sports fans obviously are notorious for not being very patient when their team is losing. So it's going to be very interesting to see. And then we have Florida State, who took on LSU. And I got to give a big old shout out to LSU fan Nate Monroe, who came on the show on Friday, wanted to talk a little bit of smack. LSU's head coach Brian Kelly also talked smack, saying they were going to go into Orlando and beat the heck out of FSU. And guess who went out of Orlando having gotten their butts kicked? That would be LSU. Florida State, LSU kept it close. They went into halftime up 17-14, and then Florida State came out of halftime and scored 31 unanswered. So FSU definitely looks like they very well could be back. We're going to see very, very quickly if they are, in fact, back.
All right, and that's our sports guy, Josh Torres. Thanks so much for coming in. And ladies and gentlemen, that is our program. You have an incredible Tuesday that feels like a Monday, but also means that Friday is coming quicker. Our team here is amazing. You guys know all their names. I'm Al Ledson. You've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9. And remember, y'all, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. And I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.